section where we're looking at some biblical characters and how they responded to suffering and trials in their life. Well, a biblical character we're going to look at for quite a while. So we're looking at, obviously, Joseph in the New Testament. And the first time we started looking at this was 2 weeks ago. And in those 2 weeks, we saw how their life, just trying to get an idea of how their life really was. We saw that 91% of the people at that time kind of lived a real hard scrabble life. You know, everything was day-to-day sustenance, you know, trying to get food and trying to live out each day. There wasn't banks for them to necessarily put money in. There weren't refrigerators. And so if they had a bad harvest, they were in a lot of trouble. You know, and they had to pay taxes and everything, and they had to pay taxes whether they had a good harvest or a bad harvest. And people generally didn't improve their lot in life. They mostly stayed where they were. That was their, that where they were born into is where they stayed, but they could easily fall down into a worse situation, with the lowest level being beggars and prostitutes and the disabled and so on, just living off of whatever people would give them. Then last week we looked at the first instance of Joseph's suffering, which was the suffering of betrayal, where he, his fiance, Mary, she became pregnant while they were engaged. And at that time, being engaged was basically the same as being married in a way. I mean, not that they lived together or anything, but just conceptually as a covenant, it was like being married. And so to this was like his spouse was committing adultery. And so how did he respond? Instead of shaming her or stoning her, instead he was gracious and he wanted to put her away secretly, which means he wanted to try to keep her dignity. But then, of course, God intervened and said, no, you know, this child is of the Holy Spirit. And so, you know, everything worked out. And so the idea was that even when somebody betrayed him, his response was not one of revenge. It was not one of hitting back. It was not trying to, you know, get his pound of flesh because of how he felt that she treated him. Instead, he was righteous, and he wanted to draw her to God and to maintain her reputation and dignity. So we're going to look today at the second one, which is Joseph and the suffering of uncertainty, confusion, and hardship. And this is the second instance of Joseph's suffering as recorded in the Bible. And the key verse here is Luke 2:4-7, which says, "Now Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family of David, in order to register along with Mary, who was betrothed to him and was pregnant. While they were there, the time came for her to give birth, and she gave birth to her firstborn son, and she wrapped him in clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn." So we're going to look at this situation, try to get a feel for what was going on there, and try to get it out of our head, you know, what it looked like based on the Christmas cards we get. It wasn't that sterile, it wasn't that nice, you know, it was a lot rougher than the whole situation from beginning to end. So we're going to take a look at that. So Mary was pregnant, probably very pregnant, and they were more than likely hoping for her to give birth at home, because they probably had prepared the surroundings already with family and friends right there, and all would go well. You know, more than likely, they had a baby's crib, they had blankets, they had people ready, they had supplies, so everything was all ready to go at home. You know, assignments were probably given out, so it's like, well, when Mary goes into labor, you get the towels, you know, and you get the basin of water, and you get the soap, and then you get my parents, and then you go get Mary's parents. You know, everything was all ready, laid out to go, and then there was this big, oh no. You know, the registry mentioned in verse 5 is defined in verses 1 through 3. It says, "Now in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census be taken of all the inhabited earth." Now when they say inhabited earth, they're not referring to Peru, you know, and Canada and everywhere. The inhabited earth back then was essentially, you know, the Europe, the Middle East that they were aware of. So this was the first census taken when Quirinius was governor of Syria, and all the people were on their way to register for the census, each to his own city. So this census was for a new Roman tax. People had to go to their ancestral home. Since David was of the house, since Joseph was of the house and family of David, he had to go to Bethlehem. So remember, people didn't travel very far back then. It's not like today, it's like, oh, you know, I think I'll go to school in Kansas, you know, so you hop on a plane and you go to Kansas and then you get your four-year degree and it's like, hey, I got a great job in Arizona, so you move to Arizona, you know. Then everybody kind of stuck sort of in the same area, and so to go to your ancestral home was not like having to go very far oftentimes. So Joseph had to go to Bethlehem. Now, it's unlikely that Mary had to go, since Joseph could have fulfilled the requirements of the census. But she came along because she was pregnant, she was going to give the baby, and you know, Joseph wanted to be there and so on. And so this way they would be together when she had the baby, because it would be unlikely that Joseph would be able to go all the way to Bethlehem, register for a census, and come all the way back before Mary gave birth, because she was that far along. But also, that Mary came along was a fulfillment of prophecy written 700 years earlier. In Micah 5:2, it says, "But as for you, Bethlehem Ephratah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will come forth for me to be a ruler in Israel. His times of coming forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity." So this is not an ordinary king. This is not a prophecy about, you know, the son of one of the current ruler or so. This is from somebody whose time was from eternity. This is a prophecy about God being born among men. 700 years ago, inconceivable. And yet, here it is. And so that Mary was pregnant at the same time as the registry and was married to a man who had to go to his ancestral home in Bethlehem, all had to come together at the same time in order to fulfill a 700-year-old prophecy. So coincidence that this just happened to work out, or divine fulfillment? You know, God works these things out. He knows what he's doing. So when God, through divine inspiration, had the prophet Micah write this prophecy, it was 700 years before it was to be fulfilled. So many things had to happen in that time. One, Israel, could have been destroyed or driven out of the land to be nomads in foreign countries. It didn't happen. Bethlehem could have been ruined, and so it was no more, or it might have been taken over by foreign rulers who would not allow Jewish customs. But no, it was still standing. Bethlehem being that small town on a hill. Rome might not have come to power, and there might not have been a census, and so no reason for Joseph and Mary to go to Bethlehem. But Rome did come together as a country. All these things happened. Certain people were born to other people over 700 years. God made sure this all worked out. Our country, the United States, is just over 200 years old. And look how much has changed in that amount of time. 500 years from now, which would obviously be the 700 years total, who can know what our country would look like? And what cities will still be here? And what people will occupy this land? And yet, with all that change, all that which is unknown, all that which is unpredictable, God made sure that this one verse of only 42 English words was precisely and exactly fulfilled 700 years later. So even something like the timing of the census and the timing of Mary's pregnancy had maybe a 1 or 2 week window. If she had given birth a month earlier, the prophecy would have failed. If she got pregnant a couple of months later, she might have stayed home because Joseph would have been able to get to Bethlehem and come home in time, and everything would have been ready. So everything worked out to that one small window of time. And so God worked it out. Prophecy was fulfilled. And we could just look at this one small example. And when we read the book of Revelation, where God predicts all these things are going to happen in the end times, we know he can work it out. He worked this out. He worked it out precisely. All the things that had to happen worked out over a 700-year time. We know that whenever the book of Revelation hits, could be a month from now, could be 500 years from now, you know, it's whenever God decides it's going to happen, it's going to happen the way he said. Because you could see in this instance, he worked this all out. So 700 years later, God worked out every little detail, even when Mary would conceive. And she gave so that she would give birth during their short stay in Bethlehem. Prophecy was fulfilled. And that was just one detail out of the many that was required for Micah 5:2 to be fulfilled, just as God said. Now, we should never doubt the sovereignty and providence of God. God is in control. And they've said, some have kind of put it together and have said there's 315 Old Testament prophecies that refer to Jesus Christ and his birth and ministry on the earth. 315 that were written hundreds of years before he ever lived. And I do have a handout on some of them. Maybe I'll pass it out next week or so. But it's just amazing. People who say, oh, the Bible's just a bunch of stories. Well, just compare what happened. And we know the Old Testament was written before the New Testament because of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So what was the uncertainty, confusion, and hardship in Joseph's suffering? So let's take a look at each part of this story and see. Okay, come on. Okay, take it. Have some coffee. This is not going. Am I facing up? Could you flip it one? There we go. Okay. There was three aspects to this. One was the journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem. The second trial in this event was finding a place to stay. And the third trial was giving birth. So we're going to look at each one of these in turn. Let's see if this works. Oh, it works. You don't have to sneak up on me, maybe. Let me see. No, it seems to be working. Thanks. It's just you're the terror of the remote. Sees you coming and it figures I better work. Okay, so the first one is the journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem. So, we've got my pointer here. So the trip from Nazareth to Bethlehem would have been about 80 miles, not a small trip. So how long would this have taken with a pregnant woman ranges from 4 days to 1 week, with more than likely it being closer to the longer time. Again, you know, they didn't hop in their Corolla, you know, and drive down these nice asphalt roads. You know, a pregnant woman, don't forget too, would have had to have stopped more often. I'm not gonna say why. If you've ever been pregnant, you would know why, or if you had a pregnant wife. And she would have gotten tired more easily. So traveling at 2 miles an hour, because again, they were on donkeys or camels or whatever was pulling. So traveling at 2 miles an hour for 6 traveling hours per day. So that would have been 12 miles per day accomplished, would take about a week. So if you do that kind of math, that's what my career is all about. I'm a data analyst, so I do these kind of calculations. So it would have taken about a week. However, the Bible, as we're so used, so right now you're probably picturing the little Christmas card. You know, there's Mary in her blue robe and outfit sitting sideways on the donkey, and there's Joseph, pulling the donkey nice and gently with the reins, and everything is nice and so on. The Bible never mentions that they had a donkey. That Mary rode on the donkey came from the proto-evangelium of James. You try to say that. Which was a second century non-biblical account of Mary's life. And this further states that Joseph saddled his donkey and, quote, and set her upon it and his son and led it, and Joseph followed. So is this book possibly correct? Oh, there it is. You say it. It also says that Joseph was an old man and had children from a previous marriage, and that one of his sons led Mary's donkey. Well, with that kind of nonsense, nothing in this text could be believed. Riding on a donkey is not comfortable, whether you're pregnant or not. And it's bouncy and rough, and a 9-month-old pregnant woman would probably have not ridden on the donkey for 80 miles. She would have probably had went a mile or two and then went into labor from all that. It's sort of like they say, if you're 9 months pregnant and you want to have a baby, put your wife into an old pickup truck and drive on a bouncy road, and she'll probably give birth within a couple of hours. Well, picture this with a pregnant woman on a donkey on a bad road. Therefore, it's considered by some that Mary either walked part of the way, all of the way, or the most likely scenario, there were some things it says about Mary. You can read those. Okay, 1, 2, 3, okay. Now, this is probably more than likely what happened, is that they traveled in a large caravan. Many people, whether from the Nazareth or from other areas, would have also had to go to Bethlehem or that area together to register. The way would have been dangerous. Robbers and wild animals would have been common. It would have been safer and more convenient to travel in a large group. In that case, her journey might have been divided between walking, riding on a donkey or a camel, or most likely she would have been in a cart being pulled along. Still bumpy, but a little bit smoother. It might have not been this long, heroic duo journey with the two of them, fighting off robbers and wild animals, but probably one shared with many fellow travelers. So now we're starting to get a context of the picture of what's going on. Mary was perhaps 9 months pregnant, her feet hurt, her back hurt, she was exhausted. They were traveling 80 miles over the course of a week, either by walking or riding in some bumpy cart. All these animals, all these people, all these carts were kicking up a lot of dust and dirt, so they were dirty and inhaling that, and they would have been really dirty, just covered with it. And so what was the hardship? Well, it should be obvious by now. Imagine you or your wife's 9 months pregnant you have to go on an 80-mile journey that's bumpy and dirty and may involve some walking. The food wouldn't have been that best. You know, they didn't have, you know, a hot dog truck in with the caravan, and then they'd stop and they'd all, you know, get, I'll take mine with mustard and sauerkraut, and then go over to the Italian ice truck. They had whatever food they could bring with them. You know, it would have to be rationed. Sleep would be intermittent. Excuse me. And perhaps most grating of all, you are told that you have to do this by your government so that you could pay more taxes. So it wasn't even like, hey, we're going to the end of it and we're going to win a trip to Jamaica, you know, or something. You know, it's like, oh, we're going so they could take more of my money and build a bigger temple to themselves with a bigger statue of themselves and put their name on the temple, you know. But Joseph did not run away with Mary and hide from his responsibilities or from the hardship that he knew was coming. He did what was right. He clearly planned ahead, and because they arrived at their destination, we know that he made sure that Mary was taken care of. And if indeed they traveled in a caravan and not the probably fanciful story of the two of them with one donkey, then Joseph arranged for them to be with a small community to help with the journey. So when we are pretty certain that a hardship or travel is coming, then we should too plan ahead and not bury our heads in the sand and hope that it goes away. We should consider how to gather others around us to support and encourage and to guide us. We should, if there are others afflicted by this hardship, then plan whatever is necessary to ensure that we all will make it through safely. If we know that resources will be thin, be they finances, emotions, health, or something else, then use those resources wisely. Stretch them out. You know, do not waste them frivolously. Consider Lamentations 1:9. She did not consider her future. Therefore, she has fallen astonishingly. So God tells us, consider our future. Don't take a glib attitude of, oh, well, God will take care of me. You know, I don't have to worry about it, you know. No, prepare. Bring others in with you. Have a community of people ready when you're going through a hardship to help you out. Be in a good church. Be with good people, you know, and make that journey together. If Joseph and Mary sat on a single donkey and did that trip by themselves for 80 miles, odds are they wouldn't have probably made it. Between the robbers, between, you know, how is he going to carry a week's worth of food on one donkey, a week's worth of water on one donkey? It doesn't make sense. Instead, he had a group of community with him. So we see this when we are, even if we don't anticipate the trial coming and it just hits us, bring people together, bring the community. Don't stay away from church. More than ever, come to church and be with people, talk to people. So we just looked at how Joseph and Mary made a week-long, bumpy and dirty 80-mile journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem. So they're thinking, we can't wait to be at our destination. You know, when we're driving 80 miles and it's hot, and don't forget, this is Israel, you know, it's not like, oh, a nice 68 degrees. You know, it's hot. You know, the sun's beating down them. Remember, as we looked at a couple of weeks ago, there's not many trees. They're just exposed. And so even if we're in a hot, you know, in a hot environment in an air-conditioned car for a couple of days, we just can't wait to get to our destination. So imagine what they were like. So imagine their joy when they first sighted Bethlehem. And he goes, look, Mary, there it is, Bethlehem. We're finally going to get some rest. You're going to be able to put your feet up in a nice place for a change. And now, here's where we have competing stories regarding where they stayed and Jesus' birth. So the most common story is that Mary and Joseph came to Bethlehem, and Joseph went to the inn to get a room. So, you know, he went to whatever it is, Motel 6, or, you know, he didn't have a lot of money, so he had to walk past, you know, the Wyndham or whatever those expensive hotels are. So he went there, but there was no room at the inn because there were so many people were there to register, and so he was turned away. And some stories have him going to several more inns and likewise being turned away. He managed to find someone who was kind-hearted and let him stay in their stable. And Mary, usually that very same night, gave birth to Jesus in the stable, surrounded by animals, and laid Jesus into a feeding trough. Do I have this? Here we go. Yeah, so, you know, the shepherds appeared, you know, the magi, usually three of them, come with their gifts. You know, after this event, we never hear about Joseph anymore because he went into the greeting card industry and made a killing, you know. And so, you know, everything went well. And this is the story that's in all the movies and the one that we're most familiar with. So, you know, we've got the scene with the, you know, the smiling animals and they're all happy and, you know, that's what we're used to. Here's the competing story. Joseph and Mary came to Bethlehem and stayed at one of their relatives' houses. But since the guest room was full, they had to sleep in the main room. After at least several days, if not weeks, Mary goes into labor. She gives birth to Jesus in the house, perhaps with a bunch of women nearby lending a hand, and puts him into the feeding trough that is the animal section of the house. So, which story is more likely? The one we're familiar with or this latter story? So, let's look at the details to try to get a feel for what was really going on at the time. First, Bethlehem. Do I have, nope. First, Bethlehem was a small town in the upper mountains of Judea. Archaeologist W.F. Albright estimated the population of Bethlehem to have been about 300 people when Jesus was born. It was not on the main highways or trade routes. It more than likely did not even have an inn. I mean, 300 people, and that's 300 people. You figure if there's five people in a household, that's only 60 buildings or so, you know. Second, there is no room for them at the inn. The Greek word for inn here is kataluma. Kataluma is used in only two other times in the New Testament. In both places, it's clear that it is a guest room in the house. There's the word, kataluma. And the first instance is Luke 22:10-12. And he, Jesus, said to them, "When you have entered the city, a man carrying a pitcher of water will meet you. Follow him into the house that he enters, and you shall say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher says to you, where is the guest room, kataluma, in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' And he will show you a large furnished upstairs room. Prepare it there." Here it is clear that this is a room, the kataluma, in a person's house. The second is a parallel passage in Mark 14, which says, "And wherever he enters, say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher says, where is my guest room, kataluma, in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples?'" In both of these cases, and the only instances in the New Testament of the word, kataluma is clearly including a guest room in a house and not an inn. Furthermore, the usual word for inn is, okay, pandokeion. You could tell I didn't go to Greek class, which means a public house for the reception of strangers. Luke 10, 34 through 35, in the story of the Good Samaritan, is the only time in the New Testament that this word is used. And came to him to and bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them, and he put him on his own animal and brought him to an inn, Pandokheion, and took care of him. On the next day, he took out the 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, take care of him, and whatever more you spend when I return, I will pay you. The only other time in the New Testament Bible that you see this word in the Greek is Acts 28:15, but that's a different word, which perhaps is better translated as tavern. So we see here that in, which is usually translated as guest room, and that it's a different Greek word than what is used for in. So many translations do indeed translate the word as guest room or something similar. What's that? The Bible in basic English translates it as house. The Common English Bible has guest room. The Complete Jewish Bible has it as living quarters. The NIV has it as guest room. And Young's Literal Translation has it as guest chamber. So that being said, most translations do have it as in, probably because that's what we expect. That's kind of what we know. And third, in Luke 2:4, reads in part, now Joseph also went to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family of David. Hospitality was profoundly important in the Middle East. Profoundly. Bethlehem was Joseph's ancestral home. Since people did not move around a lot back then, it would be safe to say that he still had relatives in Bethlehem. And if that was the case, then Joseph would have been honor-bound to seek out one of those relatives and stay in his house. And this is the most likely scenario, because in Luke 1:39 through 40 we read, now at this time Mary set out and went in a hurry to the hill country to a city of Judah, and she entered the house of Zechariah and greeted Elizabeth. Oh, there it is. Elizabeth was, and you know who Elizabeth was, you know, the mother of John the Baptist, was from the area where where Bethlehem was located. And I don't know exactly where her house, but her house was close or within a couple of miles away. If Joseph did not have any relatives in Bethlehem itself, then most likely they would have gone to Elizabeth's house directly and stayed there. But they did not. They went to Bethlehem because they knew that they didn't have to. They found room at one of Joseph's relatives' houses. Norman Bailey, a Middle Eastern and New Testament scholar, wrote, my 30-year experience with villagers in the Middle East is that the intensity of honor shown to the passing guest is still very much in force, especially when it is a returning son of the village who is seeking shelter. We have observed cases where a complete village turned out in great celebration to greet a young man who had suddenly arrived unannounced at the village, which his grandfather had left many years before. So if, however, there was not a relative in Bethlehem, then Joseph could have appealed to the fact that, quote, he was of the house and family of David. On this alone, Joseph and Mary would have been welcomed into any household. Excuse me. So, and if none of these options worked, even a total stranger would be assured of showing him hospitality. And here's 2 quick examples. In Genesis 19, 1 through 3, now the 2 angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he stood up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way. They said, no, but we shall spend the night in the public square. Yet he strongly urged them. So they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Here, two angels described as men came to Sodom and sat at the gate. Lot urged them to come into his house, where he fed them and provided a bed for sleep. And in Judges 19, the Levite came looking for his runaway concubine. He stopped at Gibeah, and even though it was a wicked city, there was still an old man who offered hospitality. In Judges 19, then the old man said, peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the public square. So he took him into his house and fed the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. So it seems highly unlikely that a man with a pregnant wife who showed up in his ancestral home, probably with still a bunch of his relatives, would have been left in the middle of the street with no one to take them in, therefore forcing them to search around and go from inn to inn to inn, and then finally settle on a horse stable because that's all they could get. Therefore, of these two versions, it seems most likely that Joseph and Mary stayed at someone's house. But that doesn't mean it was easy. You know, what to make of the phrase, no room at the inn, or no room in the guest room? More than likely, they came to a relative's house. Because of the registration, there were already people there staying at the guest room. And it would have been unconscionable for a host to move people out of the place where he told them that they could stay, even for the sake of a pregnant woman. Therefore, he most likely would have put Joseph and Mary into the main room, or what we might call the living room, where and that is where they stayed while they were in Bethlehem. So we see here the suffering of confusion and uncertainty. They get there and the guest room is filled. Where are they gonna be put up? They're put in the living room, which doesn't have a bed. It's not set up for a nice sleeping area. So we're gonna see how they responded to this discomfort, to this kind of unexpected situation in their living situation with a wife who's just about ready to give birth. And since our time is up, this kind of hopefully forces you to come next week so you could see what happens to Mary. Does she give birth? Does everything go well? You know, stay tuned and buy yourself your Christmas cards with Joseph and Mary on the donkey. So let's give thanks, and then let's eat. Let's pray. Thank you so much, Father, that you came into a situation where you weren't regaled as a great king and put gold and robes and crowns on you. Instead, you came to a family in a small, dusty, hot village. And that even just before you were born, they had to make an 80-mile journey. They were sent away, almost outcast from where everything was expected and prepared. And instead, they had to leave everything that was ready and go away a week's journey to Bethlehem. And yet, God, in your sovereignty and your omniscience, you worked it out so that it fulfilled a prophecy from 700 years prior. I pray that we would see things like this and realize you are a God who can be trusted, a God that we can put our hope in, a God we can build our foundation and our lives on. And I just ask that when we're struggling, that we would bring community together to us, and that we would rely on the support, encouragement, and comfort of others. I ask that if anybody is here at church today who's not saved, that your spirit would draw them to yourself and save them. That if we have any family members and relatives who aren't saved, that you would save them in your mercy. Pray that we would glorify you in all our ways throughout this next week and through our lives. I give you thanks now. Amen.